Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
Around noon on July 16, 1996, a 36-year-old writer named Susan Walsh told her family that she was going to run out to the payphone down the block and make a call. She left behind her purse, she left behind her beeper, she left behind her medication, and even her cigarettes. No one ever saw her again. Susan wasn't just anyone who vanished. She was a journalist who wrote about things like the Russian mob's grip on the go-go bars where she herself danced, and the strange world of people in New York City who called themselves vampires. So when she disappeared, there was no shortage of lurid headlines and theories. Maybe she got too close to the wrong story. Maybe it was the vampires. Maybe it was someone much closer to home. 30 years later, we still don't know which of those, if any, is true. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Susan Walsh. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, I haven't really told you anything about this case, but I've been complaining about how hard this episode was to write. There's so much going on.
I mean, you did mention vampires to me.
I did. That's the one thing I told you. I said this story is so hard to write. It has vampires in it. But yeah, I just had a really hard time getting a handle on it. And listen, I obviously don't want to make light of what is undeniably a tragic story. But when I was writing this, I felt like I was in the middle of one of the Stefan sketches from SNL. Because this story has everything. Strippers, the Russian mob, vampires, a connection to the Eagles.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing about Susan Walsh's life was simple, so it stands to reason that nothing about her disappearance was either. So let's get into the story of Susan Walsh. Susan Walsh was born Susan Merchant on February 18, 1960, to Martha Young and Floyd Merchant. She grew up in New Jersey in Totowa in Wayne. She had what sounds like a pretty typical middle-class childhood. Her mother was a teacher and her father was an engineer. However, Susan's parents divorced when she was a child. It sounds as though Floyd later remarried, as Susan also has two younger half-brothers. From a young age, Susan knew she wanted to be a writer. Specifically, she wanted to be a poet. After graduating from Passaic Valley Regional High School in 1978, she attended William Patterson University, where she studied English and writing and worked on the college paper. People who knew Susan in college said that she was incredibly smart, beautiful, and outgoing. Her personality fit well with reporting because she was the type of person that people wanted to talk to. They also said that she loved attention and had a flair for the dramatic. The timeline of the early 80s is a little unclear in Susan's life. As I mentioned, she graduated high school in 1978. So if she had gone directly to college and finished in 4 years, she would have graduated in 82. However, she didn't earn her degree until 84. During those 6 years between high school and the end of college, she had a lot going on. Susan was earning her degree and falling in love with journalism, but she was also looking for adventure and other ways to make money. Toward the end of her college career, she started working as a go-go dancer. She even invited her editor, friends, and some professors to a peep show on 42nd Street in Manhattan, where she was working.
She invited her professors?
Apparently.
Okay.
Around this time, Susan's drinking also became a problem. She attended an alcohol rehabilitation program, and according to one source that I read, it was there where she met her future husband. Though I do want to say I did only read that in one source, so I'm not 100% sure that they met in rehab. It could have just been
while she was going to rehab.
Or like right around that time.
Yeah.
In either case, in 1984, Susan got sober, graduated from college, and married a man named Mark Walsh. She also got pregnant. Their son David was born in 1985. In those early days, Susan was able to find work as a technical writer. According to her father, Floyd, she had a talent for taking complex subjects and breaking them down. And Susan's life could have gone on like that. She absolutely loved being a mother, and David quickly became her entire world. She could have had it all, a husband, a child, and the writing career that she dreamed of. But that wasn't to be. Susan and Mark's marriage began to sour not long after David's birth, and the couple eventually separated. They remained estranged for years, though never officially divorced. The pair was described as having a love-hate relationship. Susan couldn't be with Mark, but he was also the only person she really trusted with David. Conversely, Mark felt that he needed to remain close to Susan because he didn't completely trust her to take care of their son on her own.
Is there anything behind that, or just
I think just
the
from
alcoholism?
Well, no, because she was sober.
Right.
So I think it was more just she's a little bit flighty and, you know, she was a freelance writer and a reporter specifically. So I think also her schedule was a little bit all over the place, too. And, you know, there just wasn't a ton of stability that she could necessarily offer on her own. So like he just wanted to remain close, you know. It's this dynamic that led the family to move into a three-level building together in Nutley, New Jersey, about a half hour west of Manhattan. Susan had a one-bedroom apartment while Mark rented the basement unit, and David just kind of went back and forth between the two. Now, there's a lot of talk in the media about Nepo babies, but Susan and Mark's story proves that it doesn't always work out. The pair always struggled financially. Susan was trying to make it as a writer, and Mark was trying to make it as a musician. In fact, their financial difficulties is one of the reasons, according to Susan, that she never divorced Mark. She said she couldn't afford the $3,000 that it would cost. This is all despite the fact that Mark's brother is Joe Walsh from the Eagles.
Okay. I was wondering if that was the connection.
Yeah, it is. And honestly, it really doesn't have anything to do with the story. It's just so weird.
That is very weird. Yeah.
After Susan and Mark split, she struggled along as a freelance writer. One of her gigs was writing for the Village Voice, which at the time was one of the most respected alternative papers in the country. One day, as she was toiling away at home, she noticed a sign at the strip club across the street. It promised $200 a night for dancers, which is about what she would make in a week freelancing for different newspapers. She decided to go back into the scene and become a writer/dancer. Susan made the combo work for her. Her beat at the Village Voice essentially became the world she already knew from the inside, the sex industry. And that inside access led her to a genuinely big story. A few summers before her disappearance, she reported on the way Russian organized crime out of Brighton Beach had moved into the go-go and strip club scene in New Jersey, allegedly forcing young immigrant women to dance. It was basically a human trafficking operation. And being a dancer, she was able to get access that an ordinary reporter never could have gotten because she'd worked in the clubs herself. While working at the clubs definitely benefited Susan's writing career, in addition to giving her extra money, it eventually began to take a toll on her mental health. Despite the fact that she was dancing at several clubs, she still couldn't keep up with her bills. Her finances had gotten so bad that her home phone had been shut off for non-payment.
Okay. I was going to ask about the needing to run down the street to use a payphone.
Exactly.
Okay, got it.
On a radio show interview she did just weeks before her disappearance, Susan talked about her disillusionment with dancing, saying, quote, "At first the vibe was harsh and compelling. You're on the stage and you get attention. It's like, Daddy loves me. But I stayed in it for far too many years, and boy, what a high price I had to pay. There's a lure, and it's very hard to leave once you get into that swing. End quote. Her editor at Village Voice, James Ridgway, echoed these sentiments, telling reporters, quote, Susan would say that she was like an addict, and the whole sex business was kind of like an addiction, and she was trying to break this addiction, end quote. Addiction was, unfortunately, a recurring theme in Susan's life. Susan had long dealt with bipolar disorder, but in 1995, she decided to go off of her medication. She had a therapist who prescribed her Xanax, and she started abusing that. She also relapsed on alcohol after 11 and a half years of sobriety.
That's a long time.
So tough. Like, so scary.
Yeah.
And yeah, so she started drinking and abusing Xanax,
which had some really bad
side effects. I mean, including, from what people who knew her said, like hallucinations.
Yikes.
She was also getting sick all the time. In the days leading up to her disappearance, her friends described her as downcast and frail. She had fevers and stomach ulcers and had even gone to the hospital a few times. While Susan appeared to be in a personal downward spiral in the summer of 1996, her career was on an upward trajectory. She had worked as a research consultant on a book called Red Light, which was written by James Ridgway and Village Voice photographer Sylvia Platchy. That radio show appearance that Susan made was to promote the book. Through Susan's work on Red Light, Ridgway also helped her make connections, and Susan was consulting on three different documentaries about sex work. The publication of Red Light was a big deal for Susan, and though her editor was trying to help her get more opportunities, it was starting to become difficult. Her growing hatred of the clubs she spent her nights in and the men who patronized them was beginning to come through in her writing. Another editor who hired her as a freelance writer said that she was, quote, too unstable to work as a staff writer. Quote, she talked about stabbing men in the eyes. Her words scared me, end quote.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she was, it was getting dark, basically. One of her last big assignments that James Ridgway gave her for the Village Voice was about vampires.
Okay. I was waiting for this.
Yeah. In the mid-90s, there was a genuine subculture in New York of people who identified as vampires.
When did Interview with a Vampire come out?
Oh, early 90s, like 93, I want to say.
So is it a correlation to that?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Basically, it was club kids and goths in the downtown scene, but some of them engaged in consensual blood drinking rituals.
Gross.
And I think the story came about because blood bags were going missing from one of the hospitals.
Okay.
And so, like, the rumor was that there were, like, vampire hospital employees who were stealing blood to use in, like, the clubs, basically.
Okay.
So I think that was, like, part of what Susan was investigating, as well as, like, just the whole vampire thing in general.
Yeah.
But the ones who engaged in the blood drinking was only a small subset of the subculture. Most of New York City's vampires just enjoy dressing in goth clothes and wearing makeup, like no one was turning into a bat. So Susan started researching vampire clubs, and she reportedly got drawn into it.
Like the allure was of the subculture was pulling her into it?
Yeah.
Okay.
She even started dating one of the so-called vampires, which in general is a pretty big journalistic no-no. Like, you can't just be researching a story and start, like, sleeping with your interview subjects.
I guess that makes sense. I'm not a journalist. I don't know.
She ended up writing a piece about the whole scene for the Village Voice, but the paper refused to run it because Ridgway felt her writing had become too personal and wasn't objective. But once Susan disappeared, the media would take all of these pieces of her, the writing, the stripping, the Russian mob, the vampires, and run with it. But despite all of the sensationalism, the actual events of July 16th, 1996, the day Susan disappeared, are pretty banal. Starting a business is hard, but Shopify makes it simpler. All the tools you need to launch are already included and ready from day one. I know I have a lot of ideas in my head, and it's so hard to execute them, but Shopify's templates and AI tools will get you a stunning site up and running with no coding needed. What I love about them is how much they really try to streamline and improve the customer experience. Shopify checkout means that more customers actually buy, and returning ones can do it in a single click. And Shopify's there to support you as you're building your site. If you've got questions, their built-in AI assistant Sidekick is ready to help you build, troubleshoot, and just keep moving. Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to small businesses just getting started. Shopify makes it easier than ever to have a beautiful functional site for your business. All you need is the idea. Shopify handles the rest. Start your free trial at shopify.com/ATTWG. That's shopify.com/ATTWG to start your free trial. Shopify.com/ATTWG. Your body is already sending you signals, and for me, the signals are loud. The afternoon crashes, the plateau at the gym, the sleep issues that won't resolve. Jevity helps you look under the hood and actually address them. Jevity is the first all-in-one precision health membership that goes beyond the traditional healthcare system, which is designed to react, not to prevent. You go in once a year, get a basic panel, and here, everything looks fine. But fine is a low bar. It means nothing is critically wrong right now, not that something isn't coming around the corner. Heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, hormonal decline, these don't show up overnight. They develop quietly, sometimes for years, while the system tells you that you're healthy. With your Jevity membership, you get a dedicated 3-person care team, including a longevity specialist and clinician to guide your health journey. You get full body testing beyond blood work, including gut microbiome analysis, advanced genetic testing, cancer screening, and more. Right now, we're offering our listeners 20% off your purchase if you go to our link, gojevity.com/gone, and use code ATTWG. That's gojevity.com, gojevity.com/gone to get 20% off your purchase with promo code ATTWG. I'm really excited to tell you, we've got another banger from Kensington Publishing. And author Noelle W. Eiley, who wrote Ask for Andrea. Her new book, Gray After Dark, is incredible. It's a thriller that's inspired by a real crime, the 1984 abduction of Olympic biathlete Carrie Swenson, who was kidnapped and left stranded in the wilderness by her attackers. The story follows Miley, an injured Olympic hopeful who's spending the summer training in Idaho's remote Frank Church wilderness when she's abducted during a morning run. Suddenly, she's trapped in an off-grid cabin, miles from help, forced to rely on her athletic training, instincts, and sheer determination to stay alive. This book doesn't come out till June 30th, but I was so excited to get an early copy. And what I loved is it's not just a thriller about escaping a captor. It's also a battle against wilderness itself. Miley's stuck in the woods and realizing that surviving one more day is far from guaranteed. So if you're a fan of Freda McFadden, Karen Slaughter, John Mars, or true crime stories, Gray After Dark absolutely deserves a spot on your list. That afternoon, Susan and Mark were both home in their respective apartments with 11-year-old David, who was sick. Susan dropped David with Mark and said she was heading to a payphone about a half a block away to make a call, because as you pointed out, her phone had been shut off for non-payment.
Why wouldn't Mark just let her use his phone?
I've read a couple different things. One is that Mark was being petty and didn't want her to use his phone.
Okay.
And another is that maybe she just wanted privacy with her call.
That's fair.
So, you know, either way, a payphone was right down the street, so it didn't matter too much. However, according to the Nutley detective who later commanded the case, Stephen Rogers, no one actually saw her leave the house and no one saw her on the phone. But this is pretty much what the story has been for the past 30 years.
I just have to take a step back here.
Okay.
The detective's name was Stephen Rogers.
Yes, Captain America.
Okay. All right. With all of the weirdness of the story, right? I definitely had to point that out.
The evidence back at her apartment does back the story up to an extent. Susan left basically everything behind, her beeper, purse, money, and medication. And that makes sense if all she was doing was going down the street to make a phone call. Though she did also leave her cigarettes behind, which I find odd, because Susan was a chain smoker, and I feel like if you were going to a payphone to make a phone call, you would bring your cigarettes with you.
Yeah, sure.
But she didn't.
Unless she had one already lit in her mouth.
Yeah, and, you know, it could have been something like that, right? Yeah. Or maybe she left a pack behind but had another pack in her pocket. You know, like anything.
Yeah.
It could have been. So Susan stepped out of her apartment, presumably with change for the payphone, and then just vanished. According to news reports, it was Mark, her estranged husband, who reported Susan missing to police the next day on June 17th. Now, the early news reports are kind of all over the place in terms of what could have happened to her. The first one I was able to find came 10 days later in the Star Ledger. In it, the reporter says that detectives don't have evidence of foul play, but her mother was interviewed and said that not contacting her son for 9 days was completely insane and out of character for Susan. James Ridgway and another friend who didn't want to be identified threw out their theories for the reporter. The friend said that Susan had been depressed, but that suicide was off the table because of her son. However, they believed that there were any number of people out there who would want to hurt Susan.
Well, yeah, right away, the Russian mafia. That's the biggest one right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the vampires, because the vampire story didn't actually, like, get run, right?
Right. Which is so funny, because, like, the newspapers who wrote about the vampire angle kind of left that part out.
Of course they would.
You know, like, one did mention it, and it wasn't one of the articles that was like, maybe she got kidnapped by vampires. You know, they're just like, hey, this is what was going on in her life. And that was, you know, one of the ones where James Ridgway was interviewed, and he's like, yeah, she was working on this story, but like, we never even ran it.
Yeah. So, and even if they had run it, what would be the motivation? Because, you know, it's not
exposing
like
exposing their secrets.
I mean, sure.
Yeah. I don't know.
But the mafia had a legitimate reason to not like her.
Exactly. Ridgway was a little more circumspect about the possibility of people being after Susan, though. He said that she had become paranoid due to her illness, by which I believe he means her bipolar disorder. He said that she often talked about how the mob was after her or she was being stalked by club patrons. I mean, both of which are reasonable, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about the mob, but like, exotic dancers get stalked by club patrons, I think, pretty often. Like, I think that's fairly common to have a creep at the club who thinks that, you know, because you gave him a lap dance, you're secretly in love with him.
Right.
2 days before she disappeared, Susan and other dancers were interviewed by producer Jill Morley for her documentary Stripped. During the interview, Susan's pager went off and she said, quote, oh, that must be my stalker, end quote.
Well, how'd the stalker get her number?
Well, she didn't say who it was, and we'll get into more of the people in Susan's life,
okay,
but it was probably somebody she had a previous relationship with, like somebody who would have had her number.
Gotcha.
And Jill said that when they were interviewing, like, Susan's pager would go off like every 15 minutes. It's important to talk about Susan's state of mind in the days and weeks leading up to her disappearance. Whether the danger was real or imagined, Susan had become genuinely fearful. She believed she was being watched and followed. Her father, Floyd Merchant, said that the last time he saw her, she was terrified that someone was going to have her killed. She reportedly told people there were two contracts out on her life, and she was, in his words, quote, coming apart at the seams, end quote. Her brother, Arthur, says that a few weeks before Susan vanished, he received a rambling, disjointed phone call from her, where she talked about being in Las Vegas and helping the FBI or CIA with a case, and then she said she wanted to go watch Roseanne.
Oh, that, what?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
okay,
that's about it.
Okay.
And I have no idea if she was ever in Vegas.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Now, there are a few ways to look at all this, though. One is that Susan had bipolar disorder. She was off her medication. She was abusing Xanax, drinking again after over a decade of being sober. and in the middle of a genuine mental health crisis. The other possibility is that she was actually in danger. Because remember, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
Right.
Susan had very real problems with several people and was known to put herself in dangerous situations, which we'll get more into in a bit. But what I do want to say at this point is the biggest through line in every article that has been written about Susan over the past 3 decades is that no one who knew her, whether it's coworkers, family, friends, none of them believe that she killed herself. Every single person in her life who's been interviewed, even the ones who didn't really have like super great things to say about her, said that she would never have done that to David. As for the investigation itself, police and the prosecutor's office jumped on Susan's case quickly, but they didn't really get very far. She was, after all, an adult with what the world saw as a chaotic lifestyle. There was sex work, drug use, mental illness, and I think, fairly or not, all of that colored how seriously her disappearance was treated at the start. Her own family has said as much. Her brother Arthur has said that he believed Susan's dancing discredited her with police and detracted from the investigation. And we talk about this constantly. When the missing person doesn't fit the perfect victim mold, the urgency just isn't there in the same way. Even when they're a beautiful white woman who's connected to one of the biggest rock bands in America.
Yeah.
The first few articles I found on this story didn't include investigators who spoke directly to reporters, just vague information from unnamed sources. So what I mean by that is like the lead detective at the very beginning wasn't giving statements to the press.
Right.
But these reporters were talking to somebody within the police department and getting like basic information about the case.
So we don't know whose number was the last number on her pager.
No, nothing like that.
Because that, I mean, to me, that would be where you would start.
Sure. Yeah. So because we were just kind of getting this vague information at the beginning, reporters started just talking to people in Susan's life. And so everybody just started throwing out theories. In a July 29th article, a friend said that she thought Susan had been kidnapped by one or more of her stalkers. By August 2nd, unnamed sources within the Nutley Police Department and the prosecutor's office said they were treating her disappearance as a homicide.
That's a jump.
Exactly. Very early, too. I mean, we're talking 2 weeks after she's reported missing.
Right. With no evidence.
Yeah. And what I find really interesting is that August 2nd article is the only article I've ever read where they've said that.
Hmm.
And, you know, I'll talk about some of the later detectives and like what they kind of think. But yeah, it's weird because they did come out and say so quickly they were treating it as a homicide and then like dropped that, like never said that again.
Hmm. Do you think it was a mistake that they said that?
It could have been. But yeah, I don't know. I do think it's really interesting that the Essex County Prosecutor's Office got involved so quickly, though.
Hmm.
Because we've had cases where the prosecutor's office investigators have been involved in, you know, searching for a missing person or whatever. This is the first one that, at least that we've covered, where that's happened so quickly. And I don't really know what the reasoning is for that. If, you know, maybe they did think there was like a mafia angle or, you know, something bigger going on.
Yeah.
And they were treating it as like an abduction and a homicide. And maybe that's why the prosecutor's office. I don't know.
That would make sense, though.
Yeah. Yeah. But I did think that was interesting. So it was at around this time, August 2nd, that the media learned about the whole vampire angle and just started to run with it. The headline of this particular story is Hunt for Vanished Dancer Leads to Blood Drinkers.
Okay.
An unnamed official confirmed that the vampire angle was one avenue that detectives were looking into.
Yeah, but again, I mean, they hadn't actually run the story.
Right. But again, it's also something that they would want to look into, oh, you yeah, know? Yeah. Yeah, like, it was something sure. that was going on. And she was dating one of the guys. So, like, that very much seems like a legitimate investigative path at that point, 2.5 weeks into the investigation.
Right.
You know? Police also visited the club she worked at and interviewed management and other dancers. They spoke with Mark, her estranged husband, and her current boyfriend, a 21-year-old self-proclaimed vampire named Christian Papo. He had just moved in with Susan about a month before her disappearance.
Oh, he was living there.
He was living there.
Oh.
What I find so interesting about Susan's case, though, isn't the mobsters or the vampires. It's how it doesn't seem to follow the same script that we see so often. We've covered well over 200 cases on this show. And when we hear that the estranged husband says that his wife left the house, took nothing with her, and then just mysteriously vanished, there's one direction that story usually goes.
Yeah.
And yes, listen, Mark's story does have problems, mainly the lack of corroboration. But in this case, there are so many other things that could have happened to Susan. And if she did meet with foul play, there are several other people who could have been involved. So let's take a look at some of them. As a lifelong vegetarian, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem for me. It's a setup problem. Until I found Factor. I work from home, so theoretically, I could be cooking my own meals every day. But the truth is, I don't. So ever since I've been using Factor, it's really been a game changer. Because now I can actually eat healthy at home with very little effort. Plus, Factor has meals that are built around your goals, whether it's weight loss, overall nutrition, more protein, GLP-1 support, the list goes on. And what I love is that they're fresh and never frozen. They have over 100 rotating weekly meals, including newly launched ready-to-eat salads. I've talked before about the miso edamame salad. It's incredible. If you're ready to get started, head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscriptions only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details. The best summer pieces are the ones you end up wearing on repeat. They're comfortable, versatile, and somehow right for almost every occasion. That's why I love Quince. I'm actually wearing a pair of their 100% European linen pants right now as I'm recording this. They're perfect for a hot day like this, where I can still look put together and stay cool. But Quince is more than clothing. They have 14-karat gold jewelry that adds a subtle finishing touch, whether it's simple hoops or delicate chains. They make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. Quince also offers elevated essentials for your home, from bedding and bath to kitchen essentials and furniture. And everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. So if you want to make your summer wardrobe feel easier, go to quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ATTWG. As I said earlier, Susan and Mark had a love-hate relationship, but I haven't seen any reports of violence or anything like that within their marriage. They both loved their son, and he was homesick on the day Susan disappeared. So if something happened to Susan in Mark's apartment that day, it would have been in front of their 11-year-old son.
Right, who's old enough that would, you know, he would remember it, he would probably report it.
Yeah, like he's not a toddler, you know? He's very aware of what's going on.
Right.
Upstairs in Susan's apartment, her boyfriend was also home. Christian was 21 years old, making him 15 years younger than Susan. I don't know a whole lot about him other than the vampire thing. He was interviewed for Susan's episode of the series Never Seen Again, so like he's not in hiding or anything like that, but he doesn't have much of an internet presence. He says that he was asleep on the couch when Susan left that afternoon and has no idea what happened to her that day. However, Susan's friends have said that his story has changed a little bit over the years. Like, he said he was asleep, and then he said he was half asleep, and at one point he said he, like, said a few words to Susan before she left, just kind of things like that.
Okay.
But those weren't the only men in Susan's life. In 1991, Susan started working as a freelance writer for the pornographic magazine Screw. One night, she was at an S&M club working on a story for the magazine when she met Screw's publisher, Al Goldstein. Goldstein was married at the time and reportedly had mob connections. But the two started seeing each other. Their on-again, off-again relationship lasted for the next 4 years, until about 6 weeks before her disappearance. Remember, Christian moved in about 4 weeks prior to her disappearance.
Suspect.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap going on.
Yeah.
Goldstein spoke with the Herald News and said that in 1996, Susan was in a bad place. Quote, "She was descending. I would try to help her, but you can't save a drowning woman who doesn't want to be saved," end quote. Similarly, Susan's Village Voice editor, James Ridgway, basically forced her into counseling at one point because he was so concerned about her mental well-being. Now, sometime during the whole Al Goldstein situation, she also started dating Billy Walker, a clerical assistant at Screw. They met at a go-go club in Newark, New Jersey that he was managing at the time. They started dating and even lived together for about a year, but he moved out in November of 1995. In May 1996, about 2 months before she vanished, the two had what Walker characterized as a, quote, bitter disagreement, and she took out an order of protection against him.
Okay. Another suspect.
Billy Walker told all of this to the Jersey Journal on August 9th, about 3 weeks after Susan was last seen, but he said that he hadn't been interviewed by police yet.
Oh, interesting. But why?
I don't know. So he had an appointment. So he said he was meeting with them like the next day or whatever, but she has an active order of protection out on this man.
Right. Why wouldn't he be one of the first people you talk to?
Exactly. 3 weeks this man hadn't been interviewed.
Huh.
And he's just out like giving interviews to newspapers.
To newspapers, you're right.
Telling them about the order of protection.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's crazy.
It is. So this whole thing about the police not really looking into Walker that hard at the beginning never sat right with Christian, Susan's boyfriend. According to him, Billy Walker wasn't just a guy who worked at a magazine. He had a pretty substantial cocaine addiction and had run a biker gang. Billy also claimed to have mob ties and at some point allegedly wrote a confession in which he said he had chopped up bodies for the mafia.
Okay. This story is wild.
I know. More importantly, he had been calling Susan relentlessly in the weeks leading up to her disappearance and left threatening messages on her answering machine. Christian had an entire cassette tape of them.
I thought her phone was cut off. So it was before that?
Yeah. It was like a few weeks, I guess, before that. I don't know exactly when her phone got cut off, yeah, but yeah. Okay. Christian said that the harassment from Billy had gotten so bad that Susan came up with a plan to have him killed.
Okay.
She told Christian that she knew mobsters who came into one of the clubs she danced at in Newark. She was going to expose Billy as a rat and then blackmail them into killing him.
Okay.
It doesn't sound like the best plan.
No, certainly not.
Yeah. In 2006, Christian told the New York Post, quote, "I told her, don't do it. They might kill Billy, but they'll kill you too. She didn't listen," end quote. Then there's another man who I've only seen mentioned in one article, but he could give a huge hint into what actually happened to Susan that day. According to that very first July 26th article in the Star Ledger, in the months prior to her disappearance, Susan had started working with a man named Don Budd. Budd was a booking agent for strip clubs in the area and got her jobs at places like the Shake Her Lounge in Dunellen and the Spotlight in Manville. Crucially, The day of her disappearance, July 16th, Bud says that he received a voicemail from Susan who said that she really needed work and would dance for tips if necessary. He never ended up connecting with her that day. Now, I don't have the exact time of that phone call, but could that have been the call Susan left the house to make that day?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
If Susan was desperate for money, or more desperate than usual, could that have led to whatever happened to her on July 16th? There's one element of the coverage over the years that could be nothing, but could potentially relate to this. Now, most accounts say that Susan left the house that afternoon to use the payphone. But some articles say that she left the house and said that she was meeting someone, but would be back in about a half an hour. When I was kind of researching this, I generally dismissed the meeting someone story as just misreporting, which happens very frequently in cases like this, mainly because she didn't take anything with her.
Right. Well, yeah, that and, you know, her boyfriend was asleep, allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then why would it only be in certain articles and not all of them? Because the only person that would have known that would have been her estranged husband.
Yeah, and her son and David. Because right. I read one article, just one, that said she told David she was going out to meet someone.
I don't know if I believe that.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. That's why I kind of dismissed it. And because she didn't take anything with her, so like going out to make a phone call made a lot more sense than going out to meet someone.
Right.
But what if it was both? Susan could have made a few calls that day. She could have called her booker to see if she could work and get some quick cash, you know, leave that message. But when she couldn't reach him, she could have called someone else. That call could have been for money, drugs, basically anything. Susan was seemingly desperate that day, and there are rumors also that she had begun to accept money for sex. Though, if she did end up meeting someone while she was out, I still find it odd that she left everything behind. But a lot of articles have alluded to the fact that her drug use leading up to her disappearance went beyond just abusing Xanax. I think there are a few things, right? So, like, let's say her original plan was to call her booker, try to get a job so she can get some cash.
Yeah.
That didn't work. He wasn't there. She left a message. Then she's thinking, okay, now what? So what if it's, okay, what's another way I can get some cash soon, right?
Yeah.
She calls somebody. He comes and meets her. She's thinking it's just going to be something quick and she doesn't need to have all of her stuff with her, right? She does what she's going to do. She gets the money, goes back home. But then something happens. Similarly, what if it was drugs?
Sure.
You know? Call somebody, hey, come meet me real quick. You know, the plan was get high, go right back home. Again, you don't need to take all your stuff with you.
Yeah, but if it was drugs, she would need to have money.
Right. So, I mean, it could be a combination of drugs and sex.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Drugs instead of cash, basically.
Yeah.
One theory that has been kicked around over the years is that, you know, if it was something that had to do with drugs, like maybe she went out, was planning on coming back, but she OD'd, something along those lines.
But if she OD'd, then she'd be on the street somewhere.
Well, but not if she was like with somebody, you know, right? Like if she was in a car or something along those lines, or at somebody's house or whatever, maybe something happened, they panicked and got rid of her. Others believe that she simply left voluntarily or in her paranoid state went into hiding.
I guess. I mean, it's a possibility, but it seems kind of far-fetched.
Well, I mean, I think 30 years later, it's a lot more far-fetched than it was in, you know, the first couple weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
Because there were, after all, several reported sightings of Susan, the most credible of which was by her good friend, Melissa Hines. Melissa said that about a month after Susan went missing, she saw her friend getting into the back of a limo. Melissa got the license plate number of the limo, gave it to police, and they were able to track it down. They spoke with the driver and showed him photographs of Susan. He said that he was pretty sure she had been in his limo before, but he wasn't 100% certain. Now, I don't know the situation with this limo. I don't know if it was a for-hire car or if it was like privately owned.
Right.
So because of that, we don't know the context of like why she would have been in that. Like, does this limo belong to
a Russian mafia member?
Right, right. Yeah. Or is it just a limo that like takes people to the airport, you know? That lead, unfortunately, ended up going nowhere. Police investigated this and other sightings, and Susan's father also hired a private investigator. But ultimately, there was very little physical evidence, and the case went cold. No one has ever been arrested or charged. Over the years, various Nutley detectives have worked it, including Stephen Rogers, who we mentioned earlier, and later a detective named John Rhine. Interestingly, Rhine seems to be one of the people who believes Susan just walked away. He went on record years later saying he personally believes Susan is alive and chose to leave. Her family strongly disagrees. That's why, you know, again, it was so interesting to me when I read that article from 10 days in saying that police are treating it as a homicide when 10 years in, the lead detective is like, no, I think she's out there.
She walked away, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think Nutley police even like ended up having a working theory, it feels like.
No, yeah. I mean, well.
Not a consistent one, at least.
Not a consistent one, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The case received a new round of attention in 2006 on the 10-year anniversary. At that time, some new information was released. We learned that one of Susan's friends had gone by her apartment around the time that she went missing. She says that when she was there, the window fans had been removed and the windows were all shut. That struck her as odd because it was July and Susan's apartment didn't have air conditioning. She said that she got such an ominous feeling that she left. And later, when police looked at Susan's deed book that she was known to carry everywhere when she was working, the entire month of July 1996 had been torn out of it. To this day, nobody knows who removed those pages or why. Police also told reporters that they were taking a second look at Mark Walsh, Susan's estranged husband. He and David had led quiet lives in the decades since Susan was last seen, but police never let go of the feeling that, as the last person known to see her, he could have had some involvement. Investigators re-interviewed Mark, who still lived in the same basement apartment.
After 10 years?
He might still be there, honestly, yeah. But much like he did in 1996, in 2006, he refused to allow police to do a forensic search.
Hmm.
Police also told the New York Post that they were seeking permission to use sonar equipment to search for Susan's body. The plan was to scour a reservoir behind Mark Walsh's dad's house in nearby Montclair, New Jersey. Lieutenant Stephen Rogers told the Post, quote, "Looking at this with a fresh set of eyes reveals a set of facts that's very troubling. I'm confident we'll get to the bottom of this," end quote. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be the case. I'm not sure if they were ever able to do those sonar searches, but 2006 didn't bring any new answers in Susan's case, and it went dormant once again.
I mean, I have a hard time believing that Mark did anything, given that their 11-year-old son was home.
Yeah, I mean, unless he somehow convinced David to keep the secret.
I guess.
Neither one has ever spoken publicly about Susan. David's always refused to do interviews, so I just don't know much about him. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you, though, that it does seem unlikely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know distance-wise or their apartments are from each other.
Yeah, he was right below her.
Right. And
it was a three-unit building, so it's like one apartment per floor.
Yeah.
I don't know who lived on the top floor.
But the boyfriend was
in her apartment.
In her apartment.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, he hasn't said that he heard anything. So.
No. And he's the one who, for the past 30 years, has been saying he thinks it's Billy Walker.
Yeah.
Not Mark.
Yeah. It's easy. Well, I mean, obviously, that should be your first suspect. Your first go-to would be the estranged husband. But
yeah.
Again, with the 11-year-old there, boyfriend upstairs, neither one of them saying anything about Mark doing anything. It just, it seems, it doesn't make sense. Like it doesn't match up.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, unless they were like in on it together, which seems insane.
Yeah.
Again, Christian at the time was 21. Like, he was a kid.
Yeah.
I tried to get a little bit more information on him. I only found a few things. I found something from around 2019 where he was posting all these flyers in Brooklyn, where I think he was living at the time, about how one of his friends was trying to drive him to suicide and I think scammed him out of some money or scammed somebody else out of some money. I don't know. There was a Reddit thread about it. And then a year prior to all of this, I believe he's from Staten Island. He was in the local Staten Island paper for helping save a turtle.
Okay.
Like, that's all I've got on this guy. And he has a LinkedIn page that has nothing on it except a current position as volunteer crime fighter.
Okay.
So that's what I know about this dude.
All right.
When Susan first disappeared, he asked not to be named, right? Because like I think this whole thing like really freaked him out, as you can imagine.
Yeah, you're 21 years old.
Yeah. And he said in one of the articles, he's like, Susan was my first girlfriend. And then she like goes missing and there's Russian mobsters and like an estranged husband and all of this stuff going on.
Right.
And then in 2006, he spoke to the Post, talked about those voicemails that Billy Walker had been leaving. And then in 2023, or whenever that episode of Never Seen Again came out, he was interviewed and still had the tape and was still talking about how he thinks it was Billy Walker.
We don't know if the police ever did interview Billy.
No, they did. I mean, yeah, they did. Because, again, Billy said he was scheduled to meet with them. They just hadn't interviewed him in the first 3 weeks. The thing about the Russian mobsters, like, yes, I mean, exposing a potential human trafficking ring is not great in terms of your personal safety.
Yeah.
But that article came out 2 summers before she disappeared. This isn't something that came out a day ago. However, Susan at least told people that 7 months prior to her disappearance, they came to her house.
The Russian mafia.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe they were still upset and maybe it wasn't even about that. Like, maybe it was something else. You know what I mean? Because she said that she did know mobsters from the club in Newark where she danced. And I don't know if it was the Russian mob or if it was the regular one or what.
Yeah.
So it could have been, you know, kind of unrelated to the article, or the article could have just been a small part of it or the beginning of it or whatever it was.
Yeah. There's almost too many suspects.
That's what I'm saying. I think there are too many suspects, because then you go back to Billy Walker, who was like unhinged. And it's like, all right, you move out in November of 95, and then in May, 6 months later, you guys have such a bad argument that she gets an order of protection against you.
Right. It's that's not like what's the incremental steps to get there?
Now, I did read something from Christian. So it sounds like, listen, I mean, you know, given all the overlapping in the dates, it doesn't sound like any of these were really monogamous relationships.
Right.
Because it sounds like she might have gone back and started sleeping with Billy Walker again, kind of during this period. She was also seeing Christian, because Christian said something along the lines of like, she just couldn't get away from him. Like, she kept on going back to him.
Mm.
And I think that the drugs also might have come from that, too.
Yeah.
So there might have been a drug angle there, right? So then if you also take him at face value about him having mob connections and chopping up bodies for the mob, I mean, if he's chopping up bodies for a mob, then he has experience in getting rid of bodies.
Right.
But is any of that true? You know?
Right. Yeah. Or are all of these people talking out of their ass?
Exactly.
They all could have been making up having mob connections.
Yeah. Or they all could have had them. Like, I just don't know. In 2020, Susan's half-brother, Arthur Merchant, sued the Nutley Police Department to get access to the case file, arguing that it really wasn't an open case since they hadn't done anything with it in years. families make this argument a lot, and it generally doesn't work, but in this case it did. And in 2022, a judge actually agreed with them, ruling that the department was, quote, not actively investigating this matter, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think a big reason is because a lot of what was in the file that he was trying to get access to was the information that was from the private investigator that their father hired and then turned over to the police.
Oh.
So his argument was like, this isn't actually from the police. It was given to the police.
Right.
So like, I should be able to see it. So Susan's father died in 2013 without ever finding out what happened to his daughter. And he gave interviews over the years. It ate him up. Like it was obviously as horrible as you would think it was. I mean, same with her mother. Yeah. So I think, you know, Arthur, who's like, they have the same dad. So, you know, it's her half brother. He's the one who is trying to just do something with this case at that point, kind of after his father died. So, yeah, like I said, he got all that information a few years ago, but I just haven't heard much about it since then. And now it's 2026, and this episode is actually going to air on the day after the 30th anniversary of Susan Walsh's disappearance. 3 decades in, it doesn't appear that a lot has been ruled out in her case. It probably wasn't vampires or the Russian mob, but beyond that, pretty much everything and everyone else is still on the table. Susan Walsh has had a lot of sensational headlines attached to her name, but beyond all of the sensationalism, she was a brilliant researcher, a fearless writer, and a devoted mother. She was a real person with hopes and dreams who was halfway through her master's degree at NYU and was looking to make her mark on the world. As of now, Susan Walsh is still listed as missing, and no remains have ever been recovered. She should be a grandmother. She should still be writing. Maybe she would finally get to be the poet she wanted to be when she was a kid. Instead, she's a name attached to a set of lurid headlines that never came close to capturing who she actually was. A mother, a genuinely gifted and brave writer, and a woman who told everyone she'd be right back. Susan Walsh has been missing from Nutley, New Jersey since July 16, 1996. She's a white woman with bleach blonde hair and blue eyes, with a light complexion, pierced ears, and a scar on her right wrist. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5'6" tall and between 110 and 120 pounds. She was last seen wearing a black tank dress and black sandals and a gold ring with a black stone. Susan was 36 when she went missing. She would be 66 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Susan Walsh, please contact the Nutley Police Department at 973-284-4940. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!